Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
What you notice is lacking from Solomon's life is real relationship with God. I think that Solomon is a powerful example, a powerful warning, especially to people like me and people like you and other people who are involved in ministry. Because when you're involved in ministry and you want to do a good job for the Lord, it can get to the place that that's the reason why you seek God.
For those in ministry, Solomon serves as a powerful example and warning. In today's message, Pastor David contrasts Solomon's life with David's. He notes that while Solomon wanted wisdom so that he would be a good king of Israel, David wanted God himself. There is a difference between wanting wisdom from God so you can serve him and wanting him for who he is. David wanted the latter. He got both. Have you been seeking God for wisdom for your ministry? Seek him alone and you'll get both. Now let's join Pastor David for today's edition of Enduring Word.
You see, in my mind, Solomon is one of the most interesting and complicated characters of the Old Testament. Here, he certainly does a good thing. Listen, I'm not trying to rewrite the Bible and make it sound as if Solomon did something bad here. He did something good and God said so. But I don't think it was the best. And let me explain to you what I mean. Solomon wanted wisdom and enabling from the Lord so that he could do a good job for the Lord. Now, is that a good thing? Absolutely it is. But is that the highest purpose of life? I don't believe so. Let me put it to you this way. I think that if you would have put David into this place, that David wouldn't have asked for the ability to be a good king. You know what David would have asked for? He would have said, Lord, I want more of you. I just want to be with you. I just want to be close to you. Do you remember those lovely Psalms where David says, you know, I wish like I was one of those birds that can hang out in the temple all day long. I'm not a priest. I can't do that. I'm a king. I wish that I was one of the birds who could just fly up and nest in the temple. That's where I want to be. That's what I want to do. Now, what you notice is lacking from Solomon's life is real relationship with God. I think that Solomon is a powerful example, a powerful warning, especially to people like me and people like you and other people who are involved in ministry. Because when you're involved in ministry and you want to do a good job for the Lord, it can get to the place that that's the reason why you seek God. God, that's what I really want from you. I want you to help me so that I can serve you in the best way possible. Now, is that a bad thing? It's not a bad thing. Is it the best thing? I don't think so. This is a message that I'd really like to deliver to pastors, to church leaders, because I know in my own life, in my own soul, how easy it is to fall into this place where really what I want from the Lord is to be the best pastor, the best teacher, the best minister for him that I can be. And then the Lord says, well, don't you want to just hang out with me? Don't you just want to have some relationship with me? Well, yeah, Lord, so that I can be the best pastor and the best teacher and the best whatever minister for you. And God just says, man, you're more interested in the work. I mean, think about it. If your father had a business and your father said, I want you to come and join in with my business. Okay, great. And then pretty soon, all you talked to your dad about was the business. That's the only thing you ever wanted to spend time with your father about. You wouldn't blame your father for saying, look, don't you ever want to relate to me as your father, not just as another person in the business? So Solomon did his job well. He was as well or better than anybody else as in job performance as a king of Israel, yet as his falling away in the end showed, and we'll get to that eventually in 1 Kings 11, there was something seriously lacking in his spiritual life. Alexander McLaren says this, there is no sign in his biography that he ever had the deep inward devotion of his father. After the poet psalmist came the prosaic and keen-sided shrewd man of affairs. So you had the poet psalmist and then you had the sharp businessman. Now listen, there's obviously nothing wrong with being a sharp businessman, but Solomon seems satisfied to be that. And that's why I think that not only with the foreign wives in Egypt and the mention of the high places, but I think with the fact that there seems to be something lacking in Solomon's relationship with God, that right here in chapter 3, we already see the seeds of destruction that are going to come to full flower in chapter 11. But maybe we should just enjoy it for what it is right now. Here it's God says, verse 13, I've also given you what you have not asked for. You see, God not only answered Solomon's prayer, he answered it beyond all expectation. Solomon didn't ask for riches and honor or a long life, but God gave him those things also. And then Solomon woke up. It was a dream, but at the same time, it was a message from God. God answered Solomon's prayer and made him wise and powerful and rich and influential. His reign was glorious for Israel. Sometimes people like to talk about the golden age of Israel's history. And if they talk about a peak, a pinnacle, the pinnacle of the golden age of Israel is the reign of Solomon. At the same time, his end was tragic. I'll talk about this a little bit more at the end tonight. But I think in Solomon, we find one of the saddest examples of wasted potential that you'll ever find in the Bible. Now, we've just been told that God gave Solomon this tremendous gift of wisdom. So the writer of 1 Kings is anxious to show us an example of it. Let me show you an example of how wise Solomon was. And that's where we come to verse 16. Now, two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, oh, my lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth. And we were together. No one was with us in the house except two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while your maidservant slept and laid him in her bosom, and I laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my son, there he was dead. But when I had examined him in the morning, indeed he was not my son whom I had born. Then the other woman said, no, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. And the first woman said, no, the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. I think you have to read this and really be surprised by something here. The first thing that really impresses me about this is that Solomon took the time to hear the complaint of two prostitutes. Hey, look, he's a busy man, right? He has a lot of things to do, but it shows he's a gracious man. He took the time out to listen between an argument that came to him between two prostitutes. Although you will find some people who point out to you that in ancient Hebrew, the word for prostitute or harlot is also the same word for an innkeeper. They say, well, maybe they weren't prostitutes, but in that day, virtually all the innkeepers were prostitutes, so they were probably prostitutes. And so they lay out the problem before him. You know, you understand, you've heard this story before, probably. You know, they have the problem with the dead son, and each one claims that the living son belongs to them, and each one says that the dead son belongs to the other. It seemed like an impossible problem to solve. It was certainly the word of one prostitute against the other, and there were no independent witnesses to the events. So how could you ever solve this? Well, Solomon has the wise solution. Look at it here in verse 23. And the king said, this one says, this is my son who lives, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, no, but your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. Then the king said, bring me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. You have to say, you wouldn't blame everybody in the court of the king right then for being very nervous about this. They're saying Solomon's solution to the problem at first looks foolish, perhaps even dangerous. The wisdom of his approach is only understood when the matter was finally settled. Now, can I give just a little illustration from that? Isn't that just how it is with the wisdom of God? I mean, could you, if you were looking at Solomon with this scene and he says, bring me a sword, you'd say, Solomon, you're crazy. What are you going to do? This is dangerous. But afterwards, you say, oh, that's brilliant. You knew exactly what you're doing. Now, isn't it that way with the work of God in our life? God begins something. God begins to turn something over, turn something around in our life. We're like, oh, God, what are you doing? This is crazy. Afterwards, we say, oh, yes, Lord, you're so smart. You had it all under control. Well, it's the same way with Solomon's wisdom in this thing. So he says, bring me a sword. Verse 25, and the king said, divide the living child in two and give the half to one and half to the other. Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son. And she said, oh, my Lord, give her the living child and by no means kill him. But the other said, let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. So the king answered and said, give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She is his mother. Solomon knew that the offer to cut the child in two would reveal the true mother, and he rewarded the mother's love accordingly. You see, Solomon knew that the true parental relationship was proved by love. The true mother would rather have the child live without her than to die with her. She put the child's welfare above her own. And then you look at it back and you say, Solomon, you're brilliant. What a brilliant solution to this problem. Verse 28, and all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw the wisdom of God was with him to administer to judgment. Such a wise decision. You couldn't hide this. The matter was soon known throughout all the kingdom, and the people of Israel saw that Solomon had both the wisdom and the courage to do the right thing as a leader. This made them hesitant to disobey the law of the king. You know, when you know that the leaders, that the judges are competent and sharp and wise, you're hesitant to break the law. If you know that the law is corrupt, then you're not so hesitant to break the law. This made the people fear God and respect the law in this time of ancient Israel. That's very interesting. I have a great collection of books, this 7-volume set called The Legends of the Jews, put together by a guy named Ginsberg. And it's this marvelous collection of rabbinical legends. And most of them are totally crazy and totally fanciful. And of course, the ancient rabbis loved to make up legends about Solomon. It was just too, you know, tantalizing to resist. And so they used to tell lots of legends about the wisdom of Solomon. And Ginsberg quotes one, telling about the time when a demon showed Solomon something that Solomon had never seen before, something called a Cainite, you know, some strange descendant of Cain, who the demon brought up out of the ground. And what made a Cainite different was that the Cainite had two heads, and Solomon had never seen a being with two heads before. And so when the Cainite wanted to return again, he could not go back to his dwelling place under the earth. So he married somebody in Israel, and he had 7 sons. One of his 7 sons also had 2 heads, just like the Cainite. Now, you think, okay, well, just a crazy story from the rabbis. Oh, but they wanted to show Solomon's wisdom in this. So when the 2-headed father died, the 2-headed son said, I want a double portion of the inheritance because I'm 2 people. And so Solomon was called in to solve this very tricky legal issue. The Sanhedrin couldn't decide it. So Solomon prayed for wisdom. And do you know what he did? He finally poured hot water on one of the heads of the 2-headed son. Both heads flinched and cried out. And from this, Solomon said, you're 2 heads, but you're 1 person. And therefore, you only get 1 share of the inheritance. Well, obviously, it's just a crazy story. But the rabbis couldn't resist making up these kind of stories about Solomon and his wisdom. Well, Solomon's wisdom extended to far more than just legal decisions. He was also very capable when it came to administering his kingdom. And that's really the topic of chapter 4. It says there, so Solomon was king over all Israel. And these were his officials: Azariah, the son of Zadok, the priest; Elaphoreth and Ahiah, the sons of Shisha, scribes; Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahiluhud, the recorder; Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army; Zadok and Abiathar, the priest; Azariah, the son of Nathan, over the officers; Zabud, the son of Nathan, a priest and the king's friend; Ahishar, over the household; and Adoniram, the son of Abda, over the labor force. Now, again, just as the story in the previous chapter was an example of the great wisdom of Solomon, so is the organization of his government meant to communicate to us the great wisdom of this man. Solomon knew how to select, train and empower and then supervise leaders in a wise way, and this was obviously the strength of his kingdom. I mentioned before that many historians will sort of consider the reign of Solomon to be a golden age for the kingdom of Israel. It was the peak. Never was Israel as politically and militarily and economically and socially as prosperous and as glorious as it was during the reign of Solomon. Well, of course, you know that in any kind of operation like that, it doesn't just rely on one wise man. One wise man has to find and train and empower and delegate to other wise people to do the work. And Solomon knew how to do this. I think Solomon, one of his great keys to being an effective king, was that he was a leader of leaders. You know, no wise leader does it all themselves. They know how to delegate responsibility and authority and get the job done. Solomon's great wisdom made him a leader of other leaders. And I think it's interesting, as you look at these first six verses, it describes the priest and the scribes and the recorder and all these other people. Solomon's government was structured much like that in modern nations today. He had officials who served as ministers or secretaries over their specific areas of responsibility. You know, he had the department of this and the department of that and the ministry of this and the ministry of that. He organized it in a very modern way. But this shows us something else wonderful about Solomon's leadership. Solomon's leadership was organized. He knew that God is a God of design and organization, and that things simply operate better and more efficiently when they're organized. Now, this is an important point. For some people, this is the missing dynamic in their ministry before God. Listen, I know many people in ministry who would be much more fruitful in their ministry if they would organize it. But yet, they think that there's something spiritual about their disorganization. Well, I will say that when you look at this principle of organization throughout the Bible, one of my favorite examples of this is in the book of Numbers. When God wants to transform Israel from being this mob, this scattered bunch of slaves that escaped Egypt, and when he wants to organize them into a nation, the first thing he does is he orders them and he counts them. Very important. He says, you're going to go into the promised land as an organized group, not as a mob just coming in like a big gang. No, you're going to go in orderly, marching in order. And so he told them to count and organize. Yet at the same time, he said, don't count the tribe of Levi. You're not going to count everything. And I think this teaches us a good principle about organization, is that yes, God in general, he uses organization, he uses order, but at the same time, he wants to remind us, you can't order everything. And you have to be okay with that. You can't organize everything. You have to leave some of it just up to the hand of God. Well, Solomon seemed to have a good balance on this. And so he organized the leaders, he organized the ministries, and they seemed to operate very well. Now, verse 7, and by the way, I'm not going to read all the way through verse 7 through verse 19. If you look at it, well, I'll tell you exactly what it is. It talks about the governors over Solomon's area. Over the kingdom, Solomon appointed 12 different governors. Look at it there in verse 7. And Solomon had 12 governors over Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month of the year. And then it goes through and it describes each one of these governors and the territory that they did. I don't feel like bending my tongue around all these difficult to pronounce names. Just take it from me. Verses 7 through 19 describe these 12 governors over these 12 different areas or provinces of Israel. Now, these 12 governors were responsible for the taxation in their individual districts. The districts were not strictly made among the tribal borders, which is interesting. I mean, if you were going to divide Israel into 12 different groups, wouldn't you just do it by the tribes? Solomon said, no, let's divide it according to the mountains, the lands, and the regions. He didn't use a strict tribal separation. And I think you can say something else about Solomon's leadership because of this. Solomon's leadership was creative. I mean, it took some creativity to say, let's not separate these 12 governors among strictly tribal lines. Let's do it in a more efficient way. according to where the mountains and the rivers and the regions are, that will be better for us. And so the 12 governors all over Israel, and then it says in verse 7 that each one made provision for 1 month of the year. You see, taxes in that day were paid in grain and in livestock. If you were a farmer and it came time for you to pay your taxes, you would pay your taxes by giving one of these local governors, of course his representative, some of your cattle and some of your grain. And this is how you would pay your taxes for the year. So the governors collected the cattle and the grain, and once a month they would be responsible for furnishing the food for Solomon and his court because of this responsibility for taxation. And so here's another principle I want you to get from Solomon's leadership style. Solomon's leadership was not oppressive. It doesn't seem very much to do 1/12 of the work, does it? I mean, you can handle that, couldn't you? 1 month out of the year, I could do that. And so you could think each one of the governors of these regions didn't feel that they were being overtaxed or overworked in the expectation of Solomon and his government. And because of this, Israel was extremely prosperous. Look at verses 20 and 21. It says, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. This means that Solomon's authority extended all the way to the Euphrates River. When it mentions the river there in verse 21, it means the Euphrates River. Listen, that's far greater than the territory of Israel today. That's how far his area of influence. Now, it doesn't mean that all of that area was actually the kingdom of Israel, but it means if there were kings from other nations there, that they were tributes. They paid tribute unto Solomon, and they were under his leadership. All the way to the Euphrates, south, all the way through the Sinai to the border of Egypt. As I said before, this was a golden age for Israel. Never again did Israel enjoy such broad influence in that area of the world. And that's why we call this a golden age for Israel as a nation. The population grew. It was a season of prosperity. There was plenty of leisure time and pursuit of good pleasures for the people of Israel. Now, what else is interesting about this is Solomon reigned over this huge area, but Solomon himself was not a warrior. Solomon himself was not a general. Do you remember the contrast between David and Solomon? Solomon's a man of peace. He never used a sword. He never killed a Goliath. David was a warrior. He was a soldier, but not Solomon. This peace was achieved by King David, but it was enjoyed by King Solomon. Isn't that interesting? Solomon didn't earn his own accomplishments in this area. They were granted to him because of the warrior father that he had. Verse 22, if you want to see how prosperous the kingdom was, it says, now Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. That is an awful lot for one man to eat, and I don't know how Solomon could ever do it. No, that's just a joke, of course. This was for Solomon, and not just his household, but all of his royal court. There are estimates that this much food every day could feed 15,000 to 36,000 people.
As we are making our way through the books of 1st and 2nd Kings, King Solomon is certainly taking center stage. And his crowning achievement was the building of God's holy temple. This magnificent structure is like nothing that has ever been built on the face of the earth. And while Solomon is the most prominent of the kings in the books of 1st and 2nd Kings, there are many others highlighted in these books. Some of these kings followed after God, while others led the people into some of the most depraved and wicked times the nation of Israel has ever seen. God used Elijah and Elisha to attempt to call the people back to himself. Each day, Pastor David will share insights from these books that will bring clarity to our own walk with Jesus. We hope you'll join us again here on Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik. You can add today's message to your study library by simply giving us a call at 805-730-1400. Keep in mind, we need today's date to ensure you get the right teaching. Or send us an email. Our email address is radio@enduringword.com. That's radio@enduringword.com. And when you call or email to place an order, please let us know how God is using Enduring Word. It's always a great blessing to hear testimonies of God's work. Use the contact option at enduringword.com. At the website, you'll also find a number of Pastor David's messages for you to download for further study. Enduring Word is the radio ministry of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara, in Santa Barbara, California. Join us next time, same place, for another edition of Enduring Word.